Now, as I'm speaking to you, I am Canon Bass, the Vicar of St. Mary's Eastbourne and Rural Dean. And I'm standing now in the middle of St. Mary's Church, looking round at this ancient building, which was built in the 12th century. But on the spot where I'm standing now, there was, in fact, in Saxon times, a wooden church, and that church was dedicated to St. Michael. It is the church that served the old village of Burn, and it stood on the site of the nave of the present church. We don't know much about it, but the earliest date that we know a priest was serving here was 1054. That is 12 years before the Norman conquest. Now, most of the present church, certainly the chancel and the main four bays of the nave, were built in the 12th century between 1130 and 1190. There were smaller aisles attached to the church, and those were eventually extended. But a feature of the present church is the lovely Norman chancel arch, which is semicircular in pattern with some interesting dogtooth carving. The arches in the chancel are similarly Norman dogtooth arches, but instead of being semicircular, they have a slight point at the top, which is a little unusual for that period. Of course, when the church was first built, there was no furnishing in it at all, except the font and the altar. The church would be absolutely bare, with no chairs and no pews, and people would normally sit on the stone floor. We have various niches around the church showing where there would have been little shrines or small altars with pictures or statues of the saints behind them. And across the large Norman arch, there was a very large rood loft, large enough to contain an altar where the priest would stand and celebrate Mass. There was a circular staircase leading to this rood loft through one of the pillars in the south aisle, but that was later removed, and the loft was then reached by another circular staircase on the north side and a passage across the north chancel arch, and the passage there still remains to this day. The rood loft and the altar were removed early in the last century. We're now walking down the church towards the main chancel arch. And as I stand now at the chancel arch, we have on the left an interesting pulpit put there in the last century with the symbols of the four evangelists, St. Matthew, St. Mark, St. Luke, and St. John. On the right, over the main clergy stall, is a memorial to Canon Pitman. He was vicar here in the last century, covering most of Queen Victoria's reign, and in fact, he was vicar for 62 years. In his memory, also on my right, we have the brass lectern that was given in 1878. It's a copy of a 14th century lectern, of which there are similar copies in Dublin and in St. Matthew's Westminster. We've now moved over to the north aisle and to the arch leading into the north chapel. I've just opened the door to the circular stairway, and as we look up above the arch, where the passage is still in existence towards the rood loft, we see an ancient piece of stained glass which contains the face of Christ. To the north chapel, and this is now a large open space containing two very ancient parish chests in which we now keep candles and altar linen, but at one time they would have contained the church's records.
What date would they be?
These chests are probably about 400 years old. As I'm standing on the stone floor, every one of the stones beneath me contains an inscription. For in this chapel, there are a large number of people who have been buried underneath over the years, particularly members of the Gilbert and the Gildridge families. This was at one time the site of the old pipe organ. We now have an electronic organ, but where the pipe organ stood, the inscriptions on the floor memorials are still very distinct, and we can easily read them. I'm now moving towards the ancient screen dividing off the chapel itself from the main area. There are in all five screens in this church of different pattern, and they're all 14th century wooden screens. They have been repaired in places, but they are remarkably well preserved for their age. In the screen at which I'm now looking, there were holes drilled in the 14th century. And people have speculated as to what those holes were for. And our historians tell us that they were possibly used as a confessional. Those making their confession would kneel outside the screen and speak through the holes to the priest who would sit the other side and who would give them absolution of their sins. Also, in front of the screen, we now have two memorial books. These books contain the names of those who fell during the Great War, and also a second book of names in whose memory the altar rails in the church were presented, and those are the men in the services killed during the Second World War. A parishioner comes into church once a week and makes it her job to turn over one page of each of these memorial books so that all the names become visible in turn. Inside the chapel itself, beyond the altar rails is yet another memorial book, the pages of which are similarly turned, and those contain the names of those whose cremation ashes are buried in the churchyard. And it has been the practice to bury ashes here for the last 20 years or so. This chapel is used every Sunday for administering communion to the large congregation which we have at our parish Eucharist. It contains a number of ancient memorials around its walls, a very early crucifix sited on one of the pillars, a window at the west end, which is a modern window depicting St. Michael, reminding us of the original dedication of the church, and also three windows on the left-hand side, which were brought here only last year from the Church of St. George in Dacre Road on its demolition. These three windows are windows of St. Richard and St. Wilfrid, two Sussex saints, and a third window is that of St. Francis, which was placed near the font in St. George's Church. This year we hope to install a fourth window in a similar design to St. Francis, and that fourth window will in fact be that of St. George, reminding us of St. George's Church, and it will contain also a picture of St. George's Church, where there would normally be a castle standing on a hill in the background.
Can we mention that this was actually a gift by two people up there?
Yes. The windows of St. Richard and St. Wilfrid were in fact a memorial gift on behalf of the Gray family.
Yes, quite on quite there.
We're now passing through another of the medieval screens into the main chancel and standing before the sanctuary and the main altar of the church. The chancel itself contains the clergy and choir stalls. We have a choir of 40 people whom we squash in here each Sunday, and it is a great joy to worship in this spot. The chancel itself contains the speakers of the electronic organ, several memorials on its walls, and as I am looking now down the church, on my left are three large funeral hatchments. These are visited frequently by those interested in heraldry, for they are in fact the diamond plaques which were placed outside a house on the death of one of its inhabitants, containing the coats of arms of the husband's and the wife's families. Where one of the hatchments has a completely black background, I understand that means that both husband and wife have died. Where the other hatchments are half white and half black, the white half shows that that partner remains alive.
Do we know which families these actually came from?
I'm not sure, but it's something to do with the families in the manor house, the Gilberts or the Gildridge. On the other wall of the chancel, we have a royal coat of arms. Throughout the ages, this church was visited frequently by royalty, and the present coat of arms are those of King George III. In the same position, originally, there was a coat of arms of Charles I, but I'm told that those deteriorated and had to be destroyed. In this century, the church has been visited by royalty. We have a number of pictures of the royal family visiting here in the early part of this century, particularly King George V and Queen Mary at the time of his at the time of their silver jubilee and during the closing years of his life, when he spent a great deal of time in Eastbourne with the Devonshire family. There is a plaque in one of the front seats showing where the King and Queen sat when they visited the church. I was also told by Canon Hughes, a previous vicar of this church, in his retirement, that our present Queen and Princess Margaret, when they were children, often paid visits to the church, and in fact, on Saturday mornings, they could be found at the vicarage choosing the hymns for matins on Sunday. And in this Jubilee year, it seems to me to be of great interest to remember the associations of these years. Now I'm looking at the main altar and the sanctuary itself. There is some excellent medieval stonework in the sanctuary. The piscina on the right, which is where the bread and the wine is kept, and a water drain goes straight into the earth. The sedilia, which is the place where the priest and his assistants would sit during divine service. The ancient doorway into the sacristy, matched on the other side by an ombre arch, where there would have been the small cupboard for reserving the Blessed Sacrament. Right in the middle, and now containing the altar cross, is a 13th century stone niche. And in the early days, that niche, instead of containing a cross, would have contained a coloured statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the patron saint of the church. Above the main altar and the altar cross is the very lovely large east window dedicated to Canon Stratfield, a former vicar this century, who became Bishop of Lewes and who died in 1929. On the left of the sanctuary is a very well-preserved Easter sepulchre. And this was used in medieval times for the ceremonies on Maundy Thursday and Good Friday, when the altar cross would have been placed there as a symbol of Christ's body being placed in the tomb. And curtains would have been thrown over it, and the wooden statues of the Roman soldiers would be stood outside, symbolic of our Lord's burial tomb. We have, in fact, a record of a repair to one of these wooden Roman soldiers, so we do know that they existed. In later medieval times, not only the altar cross, but the Blessed Sacrament itself would have been reserved there from Maundy Thursday evening onwards. Also on that left-hand wall, almost at floor level, are the two most ancient memorials of the church. They're both written in Latin. One is to John King, who was a rector of this church in its early days, who became Chancellor of Chichester Cathedral, and the other is to Robert Greaves, who was vicar of this church at the time of the Commonwealth, the time of the Commonwealth government, and he was in fact relieved of his living for daring to wear a white surplice. The inscription says that he died in his 40s, having been relieved of his living, and he died literally of a broken heart. As I look up above, in the corners of the sanctuary are two stones depicting the heads of two members of a local family. And they do in fact think that these heads may represent two of the occupants of the manor house in medieval days. And right up in the roof, we have preserved for us two wooden shields. One of them, in fact, bears the letters M-A-R, Maria, and the other, the initials M-C, Mother of Christ. They are two 12th century shields, of course, placed there in honor of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Passed through another of the medieval screens and come up against the fifth screen in the south chapel. This chapel is the chapel of St. Margaret and St. Bartholomew, and we are sure that those saints were chosen as a dedication because of two people, husband and wife, who were associated with the church in its early centuries. The present chapel stands on the site of a 12th century chantry chapel, but it still contains the walled tomb of William de Neville, and that walled tomb has been dated at 1251. Other interesting stonework here is the piscina, the ombre niche, and a 12th century squint looking through to the high altar. The east window of this chapel is in fact a modern window put there at the end of the Second World War as a thanksgiving for the preservation of the church during the war bombings. These wooden screens are actually among the best examples of 14th century woodwork on the south coast. But also in this chapel is a new steel ombre let into the wall, where the Blessed Sacrament is permanently reserved for the communion of the sick, and that was placed there during last year. And hanging over it is the silver sanctuary lamp brought here from St. George's Church. Back through the south chapel, And at the entrance to the South Chapel, there is a very interesting circular area which we call the priest's hole. It's not a priest's hole, it is merely the circular area which once contained the first spiral staircase to the rood screen. The staircase has been removed, but halfway up the wall there is a very interesting hole and a cavity which goes down quite a way. Historians tell us that that cavity was probably used for the storage of church records and the church's silver vessels, and they may even have been hidden there at the time of the Commonwealth. Immediately above me, and finishing off the archway to this chapel, is a humorous face, a corbel. And in this period of time, people were not afraid of humor in the church, and we have here the face of a funny little man to whom I personally have become very attached. We are now walking back up the south aisle of the church and coming to the point where we have what is really the main entrance of the church from Church Street, the south door. And here in the archway leading into the nave, we have the carving of another head. It is believed that this head is probably a replica of the face of the mason who did the carving, or perhaps one of his friends. Outside the south door we have two other heads carved, and they too would have been the heads of local people, probably those of Baron Bartholomew and his wife Margaret, and they can be dated at 1308. Inside the south door, only a matter of some 15 years ago, a holy water stoup was uncovered, and that too is probably part of the 13th century stonework in the church. Now, as I look towards the back of the south aisle, there is another entrance arch above me. And record has it that the back part of the south aisle was once a chapel in its own right. It was probably a chantry chapel known as the Jesus Chapel, because it would have been used by the Jesus priest or the Jesuit priest in the 14th century. For records show that across the other side of Church Street there was a house owned by a brotherhood of monks, and they would probably have used this chapel for their daily mass and offices during the whole time they were here. Now, as we move into that area, which is now seated and part of the south aisle, we come across one of the most interesting memorials in the church. I'm now looking at this marble memorial, which is in memory of Henry Lushington, the eldest son of Henry Lushington, vicar of this parish during the 18th century. The son was a soldier who went out to India, and the memorial records that he survived the Black Hole of Calcutta, in which 146 people were forced to live, and he was one of the 23 who eventually escaped. But he escaped only to be killed soon afterwards in battle. The memorial records this in great detail. As we continue walking up the South Aisle towards the very back, we are still walking over gravestones, and there's every reason to believe that pretty well the whole church is buried underneath, particularly in all its aisles. It is at the back of this aisle that we have a large number of memorials, most of them referring to graves immediately outside the church walls. But also here we have a record on the wall of the vicars of this parish. We know that priests ministered here up to the 13th century, but this record goes from the 13th century, from 1244, when this became a parish in its own right under the control of the Diocese of Chichester. We're now moving across to the very back of the nave, and as I look down, I must make some comment on the stained glass windows on either side of me. For the most part, they are Victorian windows. Several of them were made in the earlier period and show signs of real craftsmanship, whilst several of the others were made in the latter part of the century, when these kind of windows were mass-produced and exported all over the British Empire, and these are of no particular interest. On the immediate left of me is a very colourful window by a Scottish artist, and unfortunately this is the window last year that was severely damaged by vandals throwing stones through it, and it's been repaired this year at a cost of some £600. Of course, insurance money covered it.
Can I just make one little comment here? Normally churches are sort of dead square, but this one actually turns a corner if you look at it.
Actually, several churches in Sussex do this, and from the back, as we're looking towards the altar, I can see the left-hand side of the chancel clearly, but the right has disappeared from view, and that is because the chancel itself is twisted. It is said that the reason for doing this is to symbolize the way in which our Lord's head on the cross hung to one side. I'm not sure whether this is true or not. I'm rather inclined to think it's more than likely that the primitive style of building is responsible for it. But nevertheless, it is a fact that the outside walls of the church are absolutely square, so the south chapel gets bigger as you go into it, the north chapel gets smaller, and then the outside walls are perfectly all right. And now we come into the area of the tower. Now the tower was built some 200 years after the rest of the church. The external stonework is mainly local greenstone, which, as you will know, is a fairly soft stone. But the walls are so thick, I don't think there's any danger whatever of the tower falling down for many years yet. And certainly we shall repair the worst parts as the years go by. Above me is a very interesting stone barrel roof. In fact, the roof is so thick that when the 8 church bells above are being rung in peal on Sunday mornings and evenings, there is great difficulty in hearing them inside the church. The insulation is so good. Now, also here is an ancient stone font, and this goes back to the 14th century. It was, in fact, stood at one time near the south door, but moved to this prominent place under the tower not so many years ago. And right underneath the font, and underneath where I'm standing, is one of the last bodies buried in this church. And it is, in fact, the body of Alexander Brodie, a vicar of this parish from 1815 to 1830, who was killed by a coach in the vicinity of the Lamb. And he is buried here underneath, and if one goes down into the heating ducts of the church, one can see his coffin quite clearly, still in very good state of preservation. It may also be interesting that during his incumbency of 15 years here, in the vicarage in which I am at present living, his wife bore him 9 children. Now, in the very east end is the oldest window in the church. The fact that it's old does not make it particularly valuable, because the glazing is not awfully good. Nevertheless, it is a memorial to Alexander Brodie. It contains the figures of the 4 evangelists. And again, this window was restored 12 months ago after vandalism, when one Saturday night a milk bottle was thrown at it and about £900 worth of damage was done. Of course, we have to live with the problem of vandalism these days. And as you know, there are a number of churches only open during set hours when people are on watch or on duty. Here, we try to keep the church open from morning till night, every day of the year. People are around most of the time, but it's always in the odd moment when someone is not here that something happens. Arms boxes are rifled, damage is done inside the church, windows are broken, and so it is impossible, really, to leave any article of value on view within the church. Of course, this church was the church which served the ancient village of Bern, which eventually became known as East Bern. And it remained the only church serving the village until the town of Eastbourne began to expand in Victorian days. The next church to be built was that of Holy Trinity, and then, of course, very quickly followed the other churches in the main part of the town: Christ Church, St. Saviour's, then St. Michael's, and All Souls. and then at the turn of the century, All Saints.
Any idea the number of people who had been in the parish up to that time?
Oddly enough, as far as we know, when Bern was a tiny village around the stream that sprung up nearby, its population was comparatively small, a matter of hundreds. But there are records in the medieval period to show a population of about 600. Strangely enough, the population varied between 600 and 1,000 for a large number of years. It was largely a farming community. There was no great expansion of any kind. And our church registers show that on at least four occasions, there were a large number of deaths during a small period, which tended, I suppose, to keep the population down. Whether this was due to one of the plagues or to some other epidemic, there is no record kept of this. Now, on the north side of the church, we have the very interesting building known as the Old Parsonage. People think that at one time the vicar lived there, but this is not true. No parson has ever lived there. It is merely the village manor house, or I suppose we would call it the estate house, where the main bailiff would have lived, looking after all the farm tenants round about. We now use it as a verger's flat on the top floor and a parish hall on the bottom floor. It is an Elizabethan manor house, and architecturally it is very good of its type. Originally on the ground floor, the middle section would have been the great hall with its large fireplace, and that would have been the main meeting place for the village. And there are records on the special festal days of gatherings and breakfasts and suppers and meals taking place there for all the village. The main fireplace still exists, and above it the racks in which would have been kept in the Tudor period the pikes used by the soldiers in any kind of defence.
I also believe that the secret passageway, which is referred to from Lamb Inn, comes out there.
Yes, the place is riddled with passages underneath, and there is a passage which is now blocked up, but this passage comes out in the corner of the old parsonage. The old parsonage also has underneath it two very, very large cellars dug out of the chalk. I imagine that it's very easy to dig into the chalk. But I believe that the main passage from the Lamb Inn to the church, or the church to the Lamb Inn, whichever way one was travelling, actually came out underneath the 14th century priest's sacristy at the east end of the church. Unfortunately, that is now blocked off too.